The talk tonight is entitled A Precious Human Life. This is from the Dalai Lama. Every day, think as you wake up. Today, I am fortunate to have woken up. I am alive. I have a precious human life. I am not going to waste it. I am going to use all of my energies to develop myself, to expand my heart out to others, to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. I am going to have kind thoughts towards others. I am not going to get angry or think badly about others. I'm going to benefit others as much as I can. This has the classic, for me, sweetness of the Dalai Lama. It also has this do and don't business in it, which for some humans only works some of the time. For example, I'm only going to have kind thoughts towards one another, or towards others. We can see just in a day and a half of practice that your mind does what it wants. And if you look around at other people, it just thinks whatever it thinks. So this has, it's not a moralistic thing to me, but it has this notion in it of what's possible. And it's, to me, it's like a vow, right? It's like a commitment. Your thinking mind is going to have whatever thoughts it's going to have, and so if it has thoughts about other beings, then it has thoughts about other beings. So then the teaching would be, okay, so see if it's possible not to follow through on those thoughts or to feed them or have more of those. It's about what we invest in. And the fantastic news, if it's not already clear, about this kind of investment is that it enhances every other aspect of your life. It enhances everything. So if the center, if you will, now I kind of said there is no center, but if the sort of core of your life is to awaken and to help others awaken, anything else that you do, anything else that you're about, would be like a ripple effect of that. So, relationally, in the developmental process, psychologically speaking, we come out into an undifferentiated, open unification of being that we don't remember. The Buddha baby. Self-consciousness develops somewhere in there. Thoughts begin. And we begin to slowly individuate from the caregiver, i.e., say, mother. We begin to actually separate. We separate physically and we begin to separate psychologically. Okay, and if that process goes fairly well, not too many sort of derailments, then we individuate, so to speak, in such a way where we're relatively comfortable being away from the caregiver. We could go to school, for example. Okay. And then eventually there's another and another psychological individuation process. There's one around puberty, and then there's another one that tends to happen around 18, 19, so to speak, in this culture, the college age time. But we can notice that there are adults well up into their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s who have not individuated very well. Okay? They're still having a hard time being themselves independent from others. They may be having a hard time being alone. Right? They, instead of being comfortable being alone, they get lonely instead and start to look for and want contact. Don't feel okay by themselves. And so it's like, we leave the womb, b- both literally and metaphorically, we leave that sort of home, nest, to branch out and to, so to speak, become ourselves, and this is psychologically speaking, only to eventually realize the deep benefit of other beings to help us realize what we really are. To come full circle, so to speak, and be able to look into the eyes of other beings and not see separation, but to see yourself, so to speak, looking at you. So this business of the Sangha or community being the most important is a very deep meditation. It's a very deep reflection to get into what does that actually mean, and to feel and deeply sense the nuances of that interconnectedness with other beings. And I don't just mean beings that are in the body. And I'm going to refer to some beings that aren't in the body. One who actually, apparently, according to legend, lived in the body 3,000 years. Now that's pretty woo. 3,000 years? Wow. Okay. In fact, let's go right to him. Well, this is Padmasambhava. He's the individual, so to speak. He's the monk, right, who brought the Buddhist teachings, brought the Dharma, Buddha Dharma, from India to Tibet. And we're going to do a little bit here with him, and then we'll do more later. He said, "My view is higher than or as vast as the sky, but my actions regarding cause and effect are as meticulous as finely sifted flour." Even the rock star from the band U2, Bono, he said, "There's more going on here than the law of cause and effect." And if you study him a little bit, he's a mystical Christian. And so he's pointing at relativity, cause and effect, and he's also, in simple terms, saying there's more going on here than that. He's saying what Padmasambhava is saying in different words. Quite different, but still the same saying, still the same message. The whole practice, the whole meditation, the whole process of living is on a foundation. And it's a foundation that, in a certain sense, is common sense. And so I've noted over the years that I, and I guess Steve as well, along with me, without us even talking about it very much, have not really talked about ethics very much. We've not really talked about the sort of the do and the don'ts. If you take the Buddhist teachings, it comes down to basically three areas of ethical behavior: right livelihood, right speech, right action. It's right there on the Eightfold Path. Fourth Noble Truth, Eightfold Path. Because most of us, based on common sense, based on some experience, do everything we can every day to not harm other beings and to not harm ourselves. Would you agree? And so, the focus in a short period of time that we have in a retreat like this goes, at least you can see with this one, goes right to the deepest place we can look at. But that doesn't negate, regardless of how much that actually works, that doesn't negate the place of ethics. Because if you're attentive to ethics, you're facing moral dilemmas almost every day. Here's a point. Here's an example of one. A story was just shared with me the other day by a woman. She went to the farmer's market to buy some groceries and whatnot, vegetables, bread perhaps. And she was over at the vegetable stand and she was looking at these shiitake mushrooms. And she was looking at the mushrooms and then the other vegetables, looking at the mushrooms, one about the mushrooms. And then she's looking at the other vegetables, and out of the corner of her eye, she sees this hand reach up and grab some of the mushrooms and put them in a basket. And she turns and looks and sees this little old man who has just stolen the mushrooms. And she has a plethora of thoughts. She looks him up and down and thinks, should I tell the vegetable stand owner about him? Should I go up to him and tell him, you shouldn't do that? Should I go up to him and say, I just saw you take those mushrooms, and watch what he does? Should I go up to him and not tell him that I saw you take the mushrooms, but simply hand him some money? And her mind went on. She told me all this. Should I go up to him and tell him, I saw you take the mushrooms. I don't think that's a very good idea. Maybe you don't have the money for them. I'll buy them for you. She thought, that's probably the one to do. But he was already gone. And there she was. Now, do I get mushrooms? There was still some left. Do I go? Not so much a moral dilemma. Do I get mushrooms? Do I not get mushrooms? Little things like this come up. Sometimes bigger things. Here's a bigger thing. A friend of mine says, you got to come with me. He said it like that. You got to come with me down to the halfway point on the western side of Baja, California. And we're going to go out, Paul, and we're going to go and be with the whales. There's these Mexican fishermen who are really poor, and they basically are part of this eco sort of tourist thing where people come down and they see these whales. They're as big as buses, Paul. They're as big as yellow school buses, and you can't get in the water with them, but you can go in the boat with the shaman Mexican fisherman who doesn't have any fish to catch anymore in the bay, he says, and we'll go out. And he said, I want you to have this experience. I said, I'm in. We drive down from San Diego, across the border, and if you've ever done this, into Tijuana. It's really easy to go into Mexico. I mean, it was then, anyways. You just drive in. Did we go through a border? Where are the guards? It's so, that day at least, disorganized. Until we got into Tijuana, and I said, hey, I got to go to the bathroom. And we're just a little ways in, we pulled over. The next thing you know, gunshots are firing. I'm going like this. And he's like, don't worry, Paul, it happens all the time here. Just relax, it's all right. Pow, pow, pow. It's like three of them. Welcome to Mexico. We go on down. We see the whales. They're wonderful beings. When they liked you, they came right up to the boat. If they really liked you, it seemed to me, these are thoughts, right? They open their mouth and let you massage their tongue. My friend said, if they really like you, then they hit you with the blow spout. It's like a hose. They line you up and they nail you. It's true. It happened. A subtle move, different than the hose. They come up underneath the boat and lift the boat up here. Now, these shaman Indian, Mexican, I'm not sure they're Indians, yeah, probably in there, they didn't talk hardly at all. There was some, we went out like five times. Like we stayed there for 5 days. And you go out for like 3 hours and the rest of the time we just sat around and just absorbed what had just happened. You know, and it really was that. Just sit there and kind of just absorb it, like what just happened. And just, that's all. That's all we did. Nothing else. But the different people would go out in the boat with us because different people were coming and going. And so there was these somewhat excited three women from, they were from New Mexico, I believe. And they were very excited, and we went out in the boat. And everybody knew that you weren't supposed to get in with the whales. There was reasons for this. But one of them got super excited, and she was just ready to dive out of the boat onto the whale. And this is, talk about impeccability. Talk about controlled folly, as Don Juan used to speak about in his books, or Carlos spoke about Don Juan. The Mexican guy's got his hand on the motor. We're just trolling next to the whale. She's trying to jump on top of the whale. He doesn't even look at her. He just reaches out with his hand, and he pulls her back in the boat. He just goes like this. And she's flopping in the boat, looks up at him, and he just goes. Like, it just shakes his head, don't do that. I didn't intend to tell you all of this, but it's fun. It's time to leave. And have you ever been someplace, have you ever been with something, and you just, the biggest feeling, the overwhelming feeling is that you don't want it to end. You don't want it to end. It's like, please, can I stay forever? Please. That's how I felt. Just go on. I mean, I can imagine I get to the point where it's like, okay, I'm done. Can we go now? That happens too, right? But anyways, that's how I'm feeling. And yeah, it's time to go. And he's, my friend's very sweet. He says, if you like it a lot, Paul, we can come back. So now we're coming back. Now, going into Mexico is one thing. Coming into America is another. It doesn't matter if you have an American passport that's well established. It doesn't matter. It's going to take longer, and you're going to be asked more questions. Now, before we even get to the border, this is what I really want to tell you. There's a community, and I mean huge community of human beings, living outside on the Mexican side of the border, on the pavement, in the lanes, and the edges. Men, women, children, dogs, cats. I didn't see any chickens. And they're living there. Why? Because the people coming into Mexico, into America from Mexico, have to stop. And by the way, if you haven't ever seen this before, the line going back in is much longer than the line getting out. And so there's these multiple lanes of cars that have to funnel down into like four to finally meet the border guards, be checked, and go through the border. Now, you can probably imagine, this means we're going to be waiting. And because we're going to be waiting, this community of people have time to find you. My friend who said, oh, I've been here and done this 12 times. This is my 13th. He looked at me and he said, pay attention. You'll find this interesting, Paul. These people living out there are begging. Not just begging, they're selling if they can. It's one scene after the other. People trying to get these people in the car to buy a carpet. It didn't look like the deal was going very well. Next thing you know, they're trying to shove the carpet into the car, trying to shove it into the back window. There's a, you know, struggle, it seems. It doesn't seem physical, but it seems more psychological. The rug gets pulled out, and the people walk away from the car. Women are walking up to the car, holding their baby. And they take the baby and just hold it up to you. Working on your ethics, you have moral dilemmas. Little boy comes up. Right arm is pretty seriously deformed. Left arm seems okay. He gets six of those, what do you call them? They're like lacrosse balls. You know how big those are? About like that. Maybe they were soft, maybe they're hard. I don't know. He's got six of them. He's juggling them in a circle like this. And he's catching them all at once. And then he stares me in the eye. I cannot give you money. I want to give you all my money. Then I'll have to ask somebody else for money so I can get home. It went on. I don't know how long it went on, but it went on for a while. One scene after the other. Very sad. Very tragic. Very moving. Very disturbing. Very enlightening. Just because we might have a sense of what right livelihood, right action, and even right speech, which is probably the more difficult one, really discover what it's like to drop gossip out of the mind? What's it like to never really, ever, maybe, again, talk about anybody else negatively? Including yourself? To tell the truth? Try to make sure you tell the truth all the time? And the only way that works or happens is you have to pay really close attention. Was that the truth? Did I say that just the way it really is, or did I change it? Our brain is a very sophisticated computer. Very sophisticated. And this part of the brain that some of us have been exploring up here with the forebrain, the thinking part up front here, front of the emotional brain, over the top of the limbic brain, the one up front here where the thoughts and images happen. A lot of stuff going on up there, huh? Addiction to being present up here. I'm present, yes. You ever noted that walking? I mentioned it yesterday, that walking meditation feels like you're feeling your feet from here. Anybody ever have a sense while they were walking, all of a sudden the head disappeared, and then you noted that the head disappeared, and when you noted that the head disappeared, the head came back? When you're, so to speak, really in your feet, there's no head. There's no thought. Now, this is right or wrong, it's just what happens. And so every bit of this language here that's being utilized to point, even if it's pointing well for you, hopefully it is some of the time, pointing directly to experience, all of this language is dualistic. Which means the word is not the thing. It simply points at the thing. And if it points well, what happens is the word disappears and the thing that the word is pointing at reveals itself. And then that thing, when seen, is realized to not be what you thought it was. Like pain. Pain is a word that describes a sensation, which is often for human beings an unpleasant sensation. As that word starts to thin a little bit or wobble or go away, and the sensation is experienced more and more directly, pretty soon that unpleasant sensation loses its abstracted label called unpleasant, and pretty soon it's just a sensation. This is one of the ways that smart people who are using mindfulness as a stress reduction, like mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is a very interesting system that takes a bit of the Buddhist teachings, right effort, right concentration primarily, and utilizes it to help relieve chronic pain. What happens there is the practitioner helps the patient or client develop clarity about the interface of their languaging brain concept onto the sensation, and they help them release around the concept, and as they help them release around the concept, they release around the pain. And as they release around the pain, they release around the suffering. Even though the language is dualistic, Steve and I are making a very sincere and continuous effort to use the language correctly. Now here's another word. It's a lovely word. It's the root word for the word numinous. The root word for the root word numinous is numen. The numen is the indwelling or guiding force, spirit, light of your being. And our opportunity here is to marry or blend this numinous nature that we are with an ethical set of actions. As I said on Friday, because we're silent and because we're doing so little, it's very difficult to mess this up. People have been known to, Steve has a story, I have a story. My story comes from when my partner and I used to do this together and then she abandoned me. Not really. She just went to her practice, which is largely informal, and I'm more of a formal guy, so I keep going with this that I'm doing. And she saw me in line getting my food. It was spaghetti, not lasagna, spaghetti. And she saw me loading up the plate, which in her opinion was excessive. And she thought, at that time we were just boyfriend, girlfriend. She said, my boyfriend is a pig. Loading up his plate with spaghetti, that's excessive, too much. She told me this later. Now, I'm going to tell you what happened, because I've shared this before with some of you. What happened on that same very day is that as I had loaded up my plate with spaghetti, perhaps truly too much, I then stumbled in the dining hall and spilled the whole thing. That's hard enough to do at home. So here we are in this silence, and this was like a lot of people. Everybody's in line right there, and they all turn and look. If nirvana means extinction, may I have it now? Please remove me from this situation permanently. Yes, tough meditative moment there. Nonetheless, that playfulness of her judgmental mind when shared with me, that playfulness and that way in which the staff attended to my extreme, I'd use that word, self-consciousness and embarrassment as I did my best to help them clean up while they said, it's okay. We'll take care of this. The numinous blending with the ethical, the right action. We're exploring the possibility of removing gradually. We don't do it, it just happens. The filter between what is being experienced and what is preferred. And this must and will include moments when what is being experienced is a clear sense of preference. The way is clear and open for he or she who has no preferences. Is that fourth Zen? third, fourth Dhamma, Zen patriarch. The way is clear and open for he or she who has no preferences. That does not mean preference never arises. Preference can and will arise when it wants to. That's how preferential it is. The opening is to see who has preference and to begin to see there's nothing there behind or owning the preference. That's what it means to have no preference. It doesn't mean there isn't any preference. It means there's no one who has it. We're exploring the possibility of easing past, and I mean that word intentionally, easing through a veil or layer or blanket that appears restrictive, which says we must be different in order to be fulfilled. Because inside that blanket or that layer or that maya or that veil is a truth, and that is this. Lack of fulfillment in one's life is directly consistent with the belief systems that are held and cherished. And it can be a belief system about anything. Happiness, enlightenment, love, non-separation, non-duality, doesn't matter. The questions that the brain has and has been having and may continue to have about anything and everything are based on the information that has been given. We don't often see this. We don't often see that the information that has been fed to us about anything and everything and nothing, there's more information potentially, somebody's talking about nothing, and that generates a question. It's based on the information that's been fed in. It's simple cause and effect in a way. What this does, however, this feeding and this process that comes out of that feeding, which is the search, which we'll go to in a moment, the search, it has us looking in the wrong direction. You may have noted, I think most of you were here in the hall when Steve gave the sitting instructions this afternoon. There was a piece in his sitting instructions, super, super gem piece. There's a lot of pieces of gem. Here's the one I want to mention. Notice, he uses his own words, notice how experience is reflecting back to the one who sees. He said it a little differently. Experience is actually a mirror that can reflect back. So the one who sees begins to see the seeing. This is so subtle and so important. And in no way negates or diminishes or shuns or pushes away experience. It's a little more nuanced than that, actually a lot, when I use the words looking in the wrong direction. The inquiry or contemplation that we're about here is into the structure of existence as it's perceived. When I said last night, nothing actually exists, because everything is becoming something other than what it was a moment before. All there is emptiness unfolding as apparent form. That's the Art Sutra, in short. If there is not an assumption up front regarding ignorance or freedom, what they are, what they aren't. If it's just enough beginner's mind, then the innocence of the presence, the innocence of the looking, the innocence of the seeing, allows a disclosure of opinions and fixations and beliefs about life, including your life. See, because that's what you say, it's happening, right? My life's happening here. It goes back here over and over and over and over and over. Even if it's things that are important, what are they important to? This. This is mine. It reflects back to this over and over and over and over and over and over and over. My life. Without knowing what my life really is, I walk and live at times assuming that it is what I think it is. And it is what I feel it is. And it is what I perceive it is. I don't even look at times and see, what is the I that's perceiving all this anyways? Where is it? And furthermore, where did that come from? And again, I already said it. It's downloaded information. All we need, as a reminder, I use these images often, a reminder, just catch, if you can, good fortune of a baby that has just learned to sit up. Catch them right there. It's a short period right there of time. Just catch them and look in their eyes when they've got that down. They've got it down. They just got up and they're now sitting. You can do this before and after this point too, and you're still going to get the same thing if you look closely. Look in their eyes and see if you can find a concept coming back at you. See if you can find an idea about anything coming back at you. You're going to be looking at pure being, and if you're receptive and not too busy up here, that pure being will reflect the pure being that's looking at the pure being. It's one pure being. Boom! The opinions, the fixations, the beliefs that are carried around in the mind, conscious, subconscious, and even unconscious. Yes, right. They're unconscious until they become conscious sometimes. And when they become conscious from an unconscious place, there's a feeling that arises with that that goes, this has been influencing. This feels like it's been here for a while. It's like the construction worker. When I used to give massage, the construction worker comes in and goes, my back is killing me. We weren't going to talk about things like, what are you aware of, anything else like that. Just he wants touch and he wants it on his back. I'm doing massage on his back, going down on his back there, giving a good technique, I hope. And all of a sudden I get this wave of anger in me. I'm like, whoa, what's this? I can get angry, I know that, but I didn't feel angry today. Can't really think of a reason to feel that. That was like an ocean wave coming through me. Finish the session, he stands up, he seems to be better, but he puts his hands back here. Pardon my French on this one, actually it's his French. Puts his hands back here and he goes, ooh, am I pissed back here? Unconscious of the anger in his back. Unconscious of the anger in his back, he's now in touch with it. I'm holding anger in my back, he says. The fixations, opinions, and beliefs are not just conscious, they're unconscious sometimes. And they are. They are. What drive the searching? They drive the searching for something other than what's happening. If fulfillment is real, if fulfillment is possible, it must be somewhere other than where I am. That's a belief. And whenever that's happening, fulfillment is bypassed. Often unconsciously. So you could say the whole path, the whole practice is based on innocence. It's based on humility. It's based on childlike innocence. In order to begin to see what's hiding inside change, beginning to see that which doesn't change, that's hiding inside change, is such an innocent opening. I would describe it as innocent as a rose that opens into the environment, ever vulnerable. The environment can come in so many different ways, circumstance, and just knock it, cut it, remove it, disturb it, and it just goes like that anyways, right there. One way to talk about the struggle is the spellbinding nature of seeking. The need to search for meaning, for purpose. We never find what we're seeking. And I'm not talking about, like, if you want to create a certain kind of profession and you want to have a certain kind of house and maybe even you're interested in certain kinds of friends, you know, and you want to have a certain kind of living space. You know, and you like certain kinds of objects. Those things can happen. Don't confuse that kind of process or living with what I'm talking about now. What I'm talking about now is the seeking for fulfillment that doesn't come and go. What I'm speaking about now is the recognition of what your life is truly about, not what you think it's about. And this isn't just one talking. There's a multiplicity of messages, ancient, I should say, coming from all different angles that are pointing at the possibility of a precious human life. We never find what we're actually seeking, spiritually speaking, in part because we don't actually even know what we're looking for. Because all we've been able to come up with when someone asks us what we want or what we're looking for is ideas or fantasy. We can't objectify it. And that's important because what we're looking for can't be objectified from the get-go. So the fact that we can't objectify it and we can only conceptualize it is an extremely important realization. But if we don't keep going, then we can just stay in subtle or not so subtle versions of this fantasy dream. We never really see what it is we're seeking, in part because we're missing what's actually here when we're seeking something other than what's here. All spiritual seeking or searching is actually an attempt to consciously or unconsciously escape what is. So a good question then would be, what then really is? What really is? Now I'm going to introduce the first and second Zen patriarch. First, Bodhidharma. Second, Huaiku. My pronunciation is not so good, but Huayku is his second Zen patriarch. The scene is Bodhidharma, and this is the first, you might say, awakened being in the Zen tradition. And the second, and they're together, and they're having a conversation. It's very simple. It goes like this. Haiku asks Bodhidharma to tranquilize his mind. And Bodhidharma says, okay, bring me your mind. And Haiku fails to find it, and therefore could not bring it. And Bodhidharma says, there, you see, I have tranquilized it for you. That could be the end of the talk. But it just might get even clearer. The illumination or deliverance that Haiku saw, that Haiku realized, is that the sought is the seeker. The sought is the seeker. Or you say it differently. The seeker is the sought. He sought the tranquilization of his mind. That's what he was seeking. And when he was asked to deliver the mind that needed tranquilization, he could not do it. These are cliffhangers. Not seeing what the seeker actually is what drives the seeking. And as long as there is seeking, what is sought is hidden. As long as there is seeking, what is sought is hidden. Let's go another angle. Say it another way. What one, i.e. you, or anybody, is looking for is hidden in the one that's looking. The seeker is the sought. And this is illuminated when the seeker can't be found. The seeker actually never actually existed. Seeking, yes. Seeking ends when it's clear there is no seeker. That's why the Sufis say, what we speak of cannot be found by seeking, but only seekers find it. This release from seeking, which is the discovery of the seeker, is exactly the same as waking up. It's what waking up is. And please don't misunderstand this waking up as waking up from being in a deep sleep to waking up into the dream sleep of the waking state. Could we acknowledge the appearance of seeking or wanting at times in the last day and a half? A little bit? Anybody completely devoid of all that? Totally? No seeking, no wanting? Okay, just want to be clear. So we're together? Okay. It is Halloween.
Oh.
Okay. And I did note coming down that more of the chocolate is gone. I hope that's bringing something of a happiness of sorts, temporary as it may be. It's Halloween, and we're all in our costumes. And your costume is whatever you think you are. Okay? And tomorrow it'll be post-Halloween, but we can still notice what we think each other is through these costumes or disguises tomorrow as well. In fact, anytime you want, you don't need a holiday to explore that. Do you know how many human beings are going to have fun tonight with a party where they will dress up in a way where no one will recognize them? What's going on there? If you've not done that, I highly recommend it at least once. I got lucky once back in college. It was time for the Halloween party, and somebody, good artist, said, "I want to paint your face." And they painted my face, and it was amazing what they did to this face. And I went to a party with all tons of people that I knew. Nobody recognized me. And as it went on and on, I had so much fun being me, unrecognized. Okay, I don't have time to do any more of that. You don't have time for me to do that. Okay. We'll talk later. So we can agree there's an appearance of seeking or wanting at times. It comes and goes, yes? Okay. But we can also notice that no seeker can be found behind or inside that seeking. Emptiness, openness, fulfillment, non-duality is what the eye does not see when it tries to look at itself. Say it again. Emptiness, openness, fulfillment, non-duality, wholeness, is what the eye does not see when it tries to look at itself. In case that feels just too much like a little brain twist or more than a little brain twist, let me say it differently. What is seen when the eye can't see itself is true openness. I invite this now, not just hear this, let it operate. What is seen when the eye can't see itself is true openness. It is space free from the concept of space. That's very important. As I mentioned before, the mind has a concept about everything, pretty much, or nothing. This scene is the scene of openness, spaciousness, ease, peace, freedom, free from the concept of space. I mentioned last night Vimalakirti Sutra. Now, Vimalakirti Sutra is a very important sutra, and it's a big sutra. Sutra means talk, sometimes translated as sermon. I'm going to use a section of it now, and it's called The Entrance into Non-Duality. None of this is planned, really. It just happens. It's amazing. I'm blown away again and again by how things just come together. And this just came together. I never heard of this sutra until 3, 4, or 5 days ago. Okay, so the scene is this. There's about 30 bodhisattvas. That's some heavy-duty hitters. They're all home run hitters. Big league guys. It's the World Series, right? Okay. Vimalakirti is one of them. They are in the presence of Crown Prince. That's a serious title. Manjushri. Manjushri Crown Prince is in attendance. The subject is non-duality. All 30 bodhisattvas weigh in with their statement on non-duality, one after the other. We don't have time for that. We're going to take 3 of 30. First bodhisattva of the 3, Dhanamati. Dhanamati says, proclaims, would be a better word, proclaims, life and liberation are dualistic. Having seen the nature of life, one is neither belonging to it, nor is one utterly liberated from it. Such understanding is the entrance to non-duality. I can imagine him standing up and saying it and then sitting down. Next bodhisattva, Paragutta, declared self and selflessness are dualistic. Since the existence of self cannot be perceived, what is there to be made selfless? Thus, the vision of their nature is the entrance into non-duality. Next, the Bodhisattva, Saramukti, declared, to say this is happiness and this is misery is duality. One who is free of all calculations, through the purity of this wisdom, mind aloof, like empty space, thus the entrance into non-duality. Imagine all additional 27 weigh in. 30 had now spoken. Crown Prince Manjushra's turn. All spoken well. Nevertheless, all of your explanations are dualistic. To know no one teaching. To express nothing. To say nothing. To explain nothing, to announce nothing, to indicate nothing, and to designate nothing. This is the entrance into non-duality. And then he goes on. We have all now given each our own part. Vimalakirti, it is now your turn to elucidate. Vimalakirti is silent and says nothing. Manjushra exclaims, excellent. This is indeed the entrance into non-duality. Here and now, there is no use for symbols, sounds, and ideas. Padmasambhava was asked by the king of Tibet to bring the teachings of Buddha Dharma to Tibet. The year is 747. Apparently, Padmasambhava brought teachings that were written as well. He had books. This is the origin of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's Padmasambhava. I want to share with you just a little bit out of the Book of Great Liberation. These texts, by the way, that Padmasambhava buried in central Tibet were found by one of the apparent reincarnations of one of his disciples. See if your heart can hear this. When you realize that all phenomena are as unstable as the air, they lose their power to fascinate and bind you. To know whether or not this is true, look inside your own mind. Arising spontaneously and free as clouds in the sky, all phenomena fade away by themselves. To know whether or not this is true, look inside your own mind. Although the clear light of reality is present in all beings, it is not recognized by them. How strange and marvelous. Although the clear light of reality shines inside their own mind, most people look outside for it. How strange and marvelous. Since there are no two such things as meditation and meditator, if by those who practice or do not practice, the meditator is sought and not found. Thereupon the goal of meditation is reached and also the end of meditation itself. Since there are no two such things as practice and practitioner, if by those who practice or do not practice, the practitioner of practice is sought and not found, thereupon the goal of practice is reached and also the end of practice itself. There are no two such things as sought and seeker, no two such things as practice and practitioner, no two such things as thought and thinker, no two such things as action and actor. When fully contemplated, the sought is found to be one with the seeker. If the seeker, when sought, cannot be found, thereupon is attained the goal of seeking and also the end of the search itself. The uncreated, self-radiant wisdom of your own original mind, actionless, immaculate, transcendent over acceptance and rejection. This itself is the perfect practice. Transcendent over acceptance and rejection. Illumination means the realization that illumination is not something that is attained. It is not something to be attained because it is not an object. It is not a thing per se, and therefore can't be compared to any sensory, mental, emotional experience. Not only that, but the seeker, or you could call the seeker the subject, you could call it the I, that seeks the object experience doesn't actually exist and can never be found. And this not finding, of the seeker is the opening of illumination. That's what cessation means. The apparent subject, or me, that thinks itself bound or seeks to be freed can't be found. And this unfinding or not finding is cessation, third noble truth. Just look. And sustain the looking until it's complete. That's where the earnestness comes in. The mind can glimpse this, it can appreciate the words at times, it can even go, aha, that's true, it seems right. Sustain the looking until it's complete. Only an object can appear to be bound. A feeling, a thought, an idea of somebody, a so-called object. Only an object can appear to be bound. And unless there is a subject that perceives it, the object doesn't exist. But if we look directly for the subject, the seeker, it is simply nothing. There's nothing there. Can't be located. Recognizing emptiness is the same as seeing that the subject, you, or awareness, is not an object. I had mixed feelings about this. There's a little ambivalence, but not enough to stop me. So this is a little mysterious here. This character appeared in somewhere around 1948, and he was very mysterious, and he wrote some books, and he was given the name, I don't know, Wee Woo Wee, and his origin and his, you know, what he was about was very, very unclear, but he wrote a number of books. This is the most direct and concise and pointing of all of his books. It was around at the time of Alan Watts, Philip Kaplow, and the others who were very there in the seminal moments of the merging of the wisdom traditions of the East, particularly Zen Buddhism, into America and Europe. Now, I'm gonna read this, and I took out just a little bit that would be hard for the mind to actually get, because the language is a little bit terse. The metaphor is of the puppet, initially. The attempt of a lived puppet, lived, quote unquote, to lead its own life is essentially the same as that of a dreamed puppet to lead his. It is as real as any dream, which I hope you see already is not real. Moreover, these attempts are the only reality the puppet could ever know. Neither the dreamed or the so-called live puppet can actually live. Neither is lived by an entity. Both are puppets reacting to impulses engendered by psychic conditions over which they have no control. Neither is sensate objectively. Neither is an entity. The apparent sentiency of both, that's sentience, is a reflex of the mind, which is all that they are. The I notion, which has intention, is itself such a reflex. Its performance as inaugurator of pretended acts of volition is a fantasy. And it is precisely this fantasy which constitutes suffering. In the absence of the fantasy of dreaming, there is the bliss of deep sleep. Let me say that again. In the absence of the fantasy of dreaming, there is the bliss of deep sleep. And in the absence of the fantasy of living, there is the joy and happiness of awakened living. Intention is the temporal cause of psychological conflict. Without intention, there is no counterpart to bliss. The term bliss here being a conventional indication of the state of unconditioned being, which is devoid of any element of objectivity. Volition, therefore, is the psychic chain that holds the phenomenal individual into apparent bondage. For volition is the pseudo-subject, false that means, attempting to act independently of the force of circumstances. The absurdity of this performance should be sufficiently evident. Whew. All the teachings of all the masters of all the schools of liberation, not just Buddhist, Vedantic, Taoist, Hindu, all indicate, in their own way, not my will but thine, O Lord. Consists in attempts by means of knowledge, practices, and maneuvers to free the pseudo, that's false, individual from the chains of volition. For when that occurs, there is no more apparent bondage. The purest doctrines, those of Ramana Maharshi, Padmasambhava, and all those of the Zen tradition, just teach us that it is sufficient by intuitive analysis utterly to comprehend that there is no entity which could have effective volition. That an apparent act of volition in accord with the inevitable can only be a vain gesture. And when in discord, the fluttering of a caged bird against the bars of a cage. When he, it's not the best word in my opinion, knows that, then at last he has peace and is glad. It may be clear, very clear, that there are actions and no actor. Doings without a doer. What is the basis for the arising of the idea of a sense of me or I that is separate. The answer is volition. We have been pointing at it. Can anyone find an I or me that has volition? That about to moment before any action takes place, the mind has claimed that moment as its own and said, this is me, and I can act from here and affect life with this. Look closely and see. Number one, what volition is. And number two, notice, is there anyone that it belongs to? Not my will but thine means the Dharma is running the show. Not my will but thine means actions without an actor, doings without a doer. It is the heart of the Bhagavad Gita. We're going to just ease off that because that was tricky for the brain, wasn't it? A little bit? Just a little? It's supposed to be. This is easier. Lao Tzu gave it and then walked away, apparently. He gave it all, laid it out, did it so concisely, so simply, so directly, and then walked away into the mist, as the legend has it. Same thing. We'll close the talk on this. The same thing. It's the same thing. It's never different. He put it like this. Every being in the universe is an expression of the Tao. Tao would be the same as Dharma. Truth. Reality. Same. It springs into existence. Unconscious, perfect, free. That's the baby. Takes on a physical body. Lets circumstances complete it. That is why every being spontaneously honors the Tao. The Tao gives birth to all beings, nourishes them, maintains them, cares for them, comforts them, protects them, and takes them back into itself. Creating without possessing. Acting without expecting. Guiding without interfering. That is why love of the Tao is in the very nature of things. We haven't really said it yet this weekend, but this inquiry, this investigation, this meditation, this looking, this awareness is love. The seeing and seeing the seer, as the Hindu term seer, is love. It's not the love that we think about. It's not the love that we sometimes feel about things. It's so subtle. It's so quiet. It's so benevolent. Love of the Tao, he's saying, is the very nature of things. The very nature of things is love. Recognizing emptiness is the same as seeing that the subject, you, or awareness, is not an object. True seeing itself is the truth. True seeing itself is the truth. It's not seeing of the truth. True seeing is the truth. It's not seeing the truth. It is the truth. The key word is. Can we sit for a couple minutes?